The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and joining me this week as my special guests are Rachel Smith, CEO and co-founder of ExchangeWire. Hi, Rachel, how are you?
Hello, very good, thanks, Grace. One of the few ExchangeWire members of staff that doesn't have COVID.
fit and healthy, unlike me.
That's it. Not that you look like you've got COVID, as I said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally the lingering remnants of...
Tail end,
yes, of freedom-defying disease. But alas, I'm here virtually. And I'm also joined by ExchangeWire Head of Content, John Still. How are you, John?
Yeah, good, thank you. The other one of the ExchangeWire staff who avoided COVID. So, yeah, delighted to be fit and healthy and reporting in for the pod. Thank you.
Delighted to have you and delighted that you're fit and healthy. And we have at least two fully healthy and fighting fit members of staff. It was touch and go for a while, listeners, but we're getting back to normal, you'll be glad to know.
Thank God, the ad tech industry can rest at ease.
Definitely no need for alarm, listeners. We're still here. And we are ready to discuss our three news stories of the week, starting with the American Data Privacy and Protection Act, or ADPA, has been advanced to a full chamber vote. The proposed bill is the first comprehensive privacy legislation to be put to a full vote in either the Senate or the House of Representatives, and if passed, would be the US's first federal privacy statute. One of the ADPA's distinguishing features is its focus on data minimization, that is, limiting the amount of data companies collect to what they would reasonably need to carry out one of 17 permitted activities. Privacy advocates may be dismayed to find that targeted advertising is listed among the 17. However, the bill would impose tighter restrictions on how much and what data can be collected for targeting, outright banning any targeting aimed at under 18s and based on sensitive data. ADPA also promises to allow consumers to opt out of personalised advertising whilst banning tactics like so-called dark patterns used by some websites to skirt GDPR stipulations in the EU. The bill will also direct the Federal Trade Commission to create a universal opt-out standard, although commentators say this will have little impact unless it is adopted by leading browsers Chrome and Safari. So this is very big news and something that I've seen a lot of excitement about online while researching this story, as well as a comment on how sort of under the radar the bill was. It seems to a lot of people to have sprung from nowhere, and yet it could have a very, very significant impact on big tech regulation and also on targeted advertising. So my first question is, do you think that if this bill is passed, it will fundamentally change targeted advertising, you know, considering the fact that the major players in the space, Facebook, Apple, etc., Google, are based in the US? Could this have massive implications on targeted advertising? I'll come to you on this one first, Rachel.
So I do think it will have huge implications because it will be, if passed, the first wide-scale piece of legislation in the US that governs what the advertising industry can get up to when it comes to data privacy. I also think the nuances, I'm calling them nuances, actually maybe a better way to describe this is the differences between this bill and, say, for example, GDPR legislation, are really significant if we think about the journey from the implication of GDPR legislation here in Europe and including the UK, since we were part of the EU when that legislation came through, and we've got pretty much mirror legislation enshrined in UK law, and where we are now. We've learned an awful lot along the way, and it feels like this piece of legislation in the US is really picking up and adopting some of the things that have not worked about GDPR. It seems to be making a genuine attempt to come up with something far more nuanced and usable. So I think it's going to have an enormous impact for that alone, because it's been shaped by some experience elsewhere and some really practical examples of how to protect user privacy and data privacy and do that with some sense of kind of consumer control and, frankly, understanding at the heart of it. So, you know, there are a number of features about this draft bill that I think are really good, which is the fact that it focuses on data minimization instead of elimination of data gathering altogether or complete control of data gathering. And I guess probably GDPR supporters and proponents would say that the purpose of GDPR was about protecting rights rather than trying to limit activity, but it had the ancillary effect of just introducing so much required and necessary control that it ended up limiting activity. And the universal opt-out, I think, is really practical and useful. And if they could actually ensure that it has some impact, there's lots of discussion, certainly in the news article that you shared, Grace, and you mentioned it in your intro, that it would really require the adoption of the major browsers in order to have some kind of impact. But imagine a universal opt-out way of navigating your way around the internet instead of having to click on consent banners all the time, cookie consent banners all the time. It would just be an immense, it would make an immense difference to people's day-to-day internet browsing lives. So those are some of the reasons why I think it'll have an enormous impact. What I found really interesting, though, is that the ANA, the Advertising Association in the US, had come out against the bill, or releasing a statement saying that they oppose the bill because it won't allow some basic demographic gathering. But yet what I find really interesting about this is that it explicitly states, the bill explicitly states, targeted advertising is included in the 17 or so particular activities that are considered legitimate for data gathering purposes. So I sort of found that a bit contrary because, quite frankly, I think a lot of advertising associations over here in Europe would think this is really an enormous improvement on the way that GDPR has been practically adopted. You know, I still would stand by what, you know, what I've said many times on the podcast and what we've talked about a lot in the intervening, whatever it is, 5-6 years or maybe less since GDPR has, I think I was on the podcast where we celebrated its birthday and I still can't remember how old it is. But I think I'd said all along that actually the point of the legislation was quite catch-all, or rather that was the outcome of the legislation was quite catch-all, and it needed to be challenged in order for the industry and for the regulators to work out what was practical or what wasn't. And I just feel like the US is giving, this piece of legislation in the US is giving a really good stab at trying to implement something that's practical, and the fact that it's got bipartisan political support is huge. Enough rambling.
I mean, so many good points. I think talking about the ANA coming out against it, the reality is that regulation's going to tighten. We're not going to go backwards. So it is, you know, I agree, quite contrary for them to come out when, you know, a kind of allowance is made for targeted advertising, and yet, that doesn't seem to satisfy them. John, what do you think about the ADPA generally in terms of its potential impact, and also, you know, on that point about the kind of advertising associations' response to it, and maybe potential other associations or advertisers' responses to it?
Yeah, I think the response, as Rachel said, it's an interesting one. It seems that the bill is very nuanced. They've put a lot of thought into it. This isn't a catch-all. This isn't a blanket or an umbrella. It is, you know, the 17 permitted activities should help the advertising industry to see the positives in it, and to understand that if regulation is going to go forward, as you say, it is, regulation will continue, will get tighter. This is a good way of doing it. This is, you know, it's the first bill of its kind to even get out of committee stage and has bipartisan support, which is incredible. But yeah, like Rachel said, it's a surprise that the industry have come out against it, because it is as helpful a legislation towards the industry as could have been expected at this point, I think. It is interesting. It's impressive that they have put so many levels and so many kind of, not caveats exactly, but, the 17 permitted activities is progress. It's allowing people to know exactly where they stand, to understand that the use of people's data can't continue as it is and needs to be restricted, but also showing its use and its necessity, the transactional data in a modern world. I think the outright banning under 18s and sensitive data use is also well thought through. We're seeing more and more stories at the moment around the use of data in young people and the impact it has on their lives and what it can do. And I think that restrictions on that can only be a positive for the industry. So yeah, I suppose like anything new, like anything that is not necessarily a threat, but something that places restrictions on the industry, the knee jerk is, it's not good news. But no, I think for this to be in front of the Senate and the House of Representatives and to have, yeah, a lot of nuance to it is an impressive start. It'd be interesting to see where it goes.
And you know what? I mean, I think, Grace, you alluded to it. Maybe the ANA have come out against it just because this is the first piece of legislation that will actually attempt to legally control the use and application of data. You've got to remember that that apart from a couple of states, California being one of them, you could basically do what you wanted with people's use of data in the US for ever since we've had GDPR in place. And that seems almost unthinkable, I think, from a European point of view, right? Because we've just been so used, we've gotten so used to being contained and controlled by legislation. So maybe they were always bound to come out fighting a little bit, whether they think it's a actually reasonably good piece of legislation or not. Perhaps they feel that in order to represent their advertiser associations and marketing associations and marketing organisations, they need to say something rather than nothing. Little do they know how bad it could have been.
Yeah, I think, you know, considering how frequently we hear of, you know, advertisers clinging onto the third party cookie, I think it's fair to say there's a trend of a reluctance to let go of certain things or yield on certain points. So yeah, it could well be that they're just trying to fight their corner for as long as possible. I think another interesting, you know, point to go on this, and you talked about this a bit, Rachel, as well, is, you know, the kind of learnings from GDPR, you know, the fact that it explicitly kind of, the ADPA that is, explicitly tries to, you know, circumvent dark patterns and, you know, strategies that have been put in place in order to get around GDPR. Do you think having taken those sorts of learnings, if you like, the ADPA could prove more successful in reinforcement? We've seen a lot of issues with, you know, GDPR enforcement and even the speed at which cases are taken. I know it's different because obviously it's a block and it's cross nations and such, but do you think that having this comprehensive federal piece of law that has, you know, modelled itself on a pre-existing piece of legislation that has had some teething pains, it could prove more successful and more effective at actually, you know, making sure that data restrictions are, or data minimisation, I should say, is adhered to?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it will be more impactful from an actual enforcement point of view as a result of that. I also think what's interesting about the bipartisan political support is it does suggest that when it comes to enforcement, there'll be more of a unilateral approach. It was quite interesting that some of the amendments to the bill that the article which you shared, Grace, talked about was what was appealing to the Republicans and what was appealing to the Democrats. And I found that really fascinating, right? So the idea that it will preempt state law, which was really unpopular with the Republicans, but that suggests to me that they've got to focus on enforcement. You know, actually, there's no point in having this if state law preempts it, because it just means that it can get passed in state law and then it's going to go up the food chain and eventually get challenged at federal level, and that will just be a whole lot of rigmarole and red tape. So that seems like a practical, useful amendment. But then, you know, it also was interesting that they introduced the ability for individuals to legally challenge organisations who they deem to be contravening the Act and the requirements, which appeals to the Republicans, and might also introduce another kind of layer of legal red tape. But that's a whole other world anyway, because let's face it, you know, the US is such a litigious environment in comparison to other countries. So they're always at the risk of heading down some kind of lawsuit territory. So at its core, if this is actually about enforcing the legislation, and actually, let's not even talk about enforcement for a minute. Again, as you suggested, Grace, maybe it's actually just about compelling people to comply with the sentimentality behind the legislation, which is data minimization. If we looked at it from that point of view, I think this is a far better effort than GDPR was at trying to corral an industry and it's not just the marketing and advertising industry, it's many other industries as well, to think about the ways in which they use and apply data and do that responsibly and do that with some respect of the end user and the consumer at its heart. And I think this is far more encouraging than any other legislation we've seen.
Yeah, I think it's useful for them to have had GDPR to look back over. To have a building block, to have a foundation in place that you can look on and build on is always going to be a great place to start. And I think they'll have looked and they have seen that turning off the tap is not the best way to impose legislation or to appease the companies. They have taken a different approach where they are not turning off entirely. They are just looking to minimize the flow. And I think that will help in terms of its success. I think the key is going to, like Rachel said, is going to be in the enforcement to make sure that, you know, it has the support, it appeases both sides, Republican and Democrat, but making sure that it's not just a hollow piece of legislation that can get passed around any part of the US political system, to make sure that it matters to the companies to get there are basically ramifications for those who do not apply. I think that's going to be the key, is making sure that it means something this time.
Well, it's a very exciting news story. Obviously more exciting if it actually goes ahead and we see what happens, and hopefully we'll have more to report on it on another podcast. There's certainly more we could talk about now, but I'll move us on to our next story, which is that Amazon have purchased One Medical for around $3.9 billion. The acquisition, which was announced last Thursday, increases the online giant's presence in the healthcare space, a sector which Amazon Health Services SVP Neil Lindsay says needs reinvention. Having gone public in 2020, One Medical operates 188 primary care facilities across 25 markets and offers remote medical services. Amazon staked their first claim in the health service space with the acquisition of online pharmacy PillPack in 2018 and have since expanded their Amazon Care telehealth service. I guess what piqued my interest with this story is the fact that, you know, Amazon have faced scrutiny and, you know, have been at the heart of certain cases involving, you know, data leaks, data breaches, and also antitrust. And I think this story kind of feeds into both, because obviously health is a highly sensitive area. Obviously, it will involve a lot of sensitive data being collected. And also, you know, Amazon have expanded into numerous areas already, are incredibly dominant. And I think this could raise the question of, you know, whether they'll face additional scrutiny from that sort of perspective if they claim a bigger stake in the health sector. So, you know, I think I'll stick with the first point, which is really about, you know, data protection and collection and use. You know, they've recently been fined by the French authority, the EU, and have been, you know, subject to a number of data breaches and hacks, both internally and externally. So do you think that there will be quite a lot of scrutiny or maybe wariness about Amazon kind of expanding in this space, where they will be obviously collecting more sensitive data? Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, well, perhaps let's hope that the aforementioned data privacy legislation goes through in enough time to make sure that there are plenty of incentives in place for Amazon to avoid breaching any of those requirements. I mean, that's a really interesting question, though, Grace, because when I read it, when I read the news article, it was the first thing I thought of was, how would I feel about Amazon being the ultimate owner of my medical and healthcare data? And I wouldn't feel very comfortable about that. But then perhaps I'm a bit paranoid and a bit, and have spent too much time working in the advertising and marketing industry. But what I also know from, the point of view of the way that the healthcare service and system is run here in the UK is that information can be incredibly sensitive, as we all know. That's logical, but also it can be incredibly valuable. So I guess what concerns me is that would Amazon, I don't know, what kind of legal controls would be in place to make sure that data doesn't leave that particular part of the healthcare service, however it gets set up, if it retains its sort of standalone status as One Medical, or if it rebrands, or if it becomes part of another company. You would just want to make sure that there is no temptation whatsoever for Amazon or any other Amazon-owned company to be using that data for other things, because it could be incredibly powerful. This is not just what people are browsing online. It's also what medication people are taking, what tests they've received and haven't received, what other, you know, various highly sensitive medical data and information might be available about them. On the other hand, I know from, you know, my days when I used to work in the public sector, a lot of that data and information that here in the UK the NHS would hold is actually really, really helpful from a public sector service planning point of view. So I know that that data and information, anonymised and subject to all sorts of data privacy controls, is really important for making decisions like how do you, you know, where should you be building new healthcare facilities, new healthcare centres, what kinds of healthcare facilities and centres should you be investing in, what kind of healthcare conditions are, you know, increasing and decreasing, and therefore where should funding go. But that's one of the reasons why I feel entirely more comfortable about a government-owned healthcare system that controls and contains all of that data rather than a privatised one. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm giving a very articulate answer on that, because I feel so compromised having grown up and now in my adult life lived in countries that have got big public healthcare systems. If I was American, maybe I'd feel completely differently about it, because I'd already be going to Amazon to buy my medication because they've got online pharmacies. I mean, what the actual, like, it's just that sort of stuff just doesn't exist in the UK. So my frame of reference is a bit narrow, is what I would say in response to that question.
Fair enough. John, what do you think?
In terms of them facing more scrutiny around privacy and around competition, all I can say is I really, really hope so. I can only echo Rachel's sentiments on how important that data is and how different this is from me looking at Amazon and wanting to buy nappies for my daughter on Amazon to having mine or her health details being used by the same company. The pharmaceutical sector is worth $934 billion globally. So I can see, you know, this is another tentacle for Amazon. It's another potential revenue stream. But there is a concern certainly around that, around a private company, particularly one with Amazon's record on cookie consent, on GDPR violations, having people's sensitive health data. There is, in their press releases about this, there's a lot of talk about disruption, particularly in the telehealth sector. And that's probably true. There is, you know, we've learned since the pandemic that online appointments are important. Telehealth is important. You can now ring and talk to your GP. You're much more likely to have a phone call from your GP than you ever are to be able to go into the surgery for an appointment. And people need greater access to healthcare services. But the data side, and again, this is from the same position Rachel has as someone who's grown up in countries with public health service, with the National Health Service for me. I have no confidence in that I would be going to an Amazon GP for my Amazon medication, and that they would not be sending that to any other branch of their organization to try and sell me other things or try and push other medication my way. So, I don't want to be a voice of doom and gloom here. I can see why they're getting into it. I would just personally have grave concerns about using the service and would really hope that there was a stiff level of scrutiny going into Amazon becoming a health player.
Yeah, I mean, sorry to interrupt there, Grace, but I just can't help myself, John. There's so many good points in there. I think that the idea that that Amazon is just getting into the healthcare sector, or not just, but they're getting into the healthcare sector because it's ripe for disruption, that's one thing, but it's also enormously profitable. And so I just feel as though another element to this is that we're on the cusp of this disruption, which has been enormously accelerated as a result of the pandemic. There's absolutely no way, if the pandemic had come along, that big swathes of the population here in the UK as well would be even remotely comfortable with the idea of mostly only accessing their GP services via an app or on the telephone. That kind of behaviour change just doesn't happen that quickly unless an enormous traumatic event comes along. And that's what happened. We had a huge traumatic event, and this is one of those areas of our society that got completely revolutionized sort of effectively overnight, I think, as the history books will tell us. Not saying that we weren't heading in a direction of trying to provide some more telehealth and remote healthcare services. It makes sense for so many reasons, but there's absolutely no way we'd have been as comfortable as we are with it today if the pandemic hadn't come along. Same as things like remote working. So there's some good things about that, which is widening people's access to healthcare services, but there needs to be an adult in the room to control all of that, right? And for me, I would want that to be a government organisation or institution, because it's got to be impartial. It has to be uninterested in the profit associated with this. And while we're on it, I was just thinking as I was reading this story, didn't I see a chart this week about the size of Amazon's advertising business? And I did. Scott Galloway, who sends around his chart of the week, sent a really interesting chart that showed that the size of Amazon's advertising business last year exceeded the size of the entire global advertising revenue sought from the newspaper industry. So I think it was $31 billion they made out of advertising in 2021, and the newspaper industry made something like $30 billion in advertising revenue. So, you know, they're still making a shit ton of money elsewhere, never mind them expanding into the healthcare sector. Rant over.
No, it's, I think those, that it's not a rant, it's completely valid, because they do have that much from their advertising business, and how much more do they need? Why are Amazon looking at these areas? And I think another concern with it being something as serious as health and something as serious as private health data is that when Amazon are expanding for what sometimes feels like the sake of expansion, whether the due care and attention will go into their health aspect of their business, whether it'll be done properly, or whether it is just another access to revenue, another side, another move for another tentacle to move into. And I would also be concerned about whether the due care and attention would be taken over what they were doing, rather than just a platform for selling medication and making more quick money.
I mean, considering everything that you've said, you know, I think it's more than likely we will see at least a push for some sort of, tighter regulation. And, you know, it may, as you mentioned, Rachel, galvanise the ADPA above. But do you think as well that this could be, this acquisition could be foiled or could be subject to an antitrust case? Amazon did have one dismissed actually in the US earlier this year, but they are facing another two at the moment, one from the European Commission and one from the CMA. Do you think that this is exposing them to another potential case? And, you know, would that be a rather comforting thing considering everything we've spoken about? If, you know, if the privacy element doesn't come in, perhaps an anti-competitive aspect might come in.
Yeah, I totally think that they will be definitely put under that scrutiny. And if they're not, then, you know, public legislators and frankly, private sector companies that are already running their own telehealthcare businesses aren't doing their jobs properly. People will be jumping up and down about this, concerned about all of the things that we've talked about, but also just them taking more money out of another market when they're already such an enormous company anyway. So the thing is, there could be lots of opportunity in that, though, because if it's the case that after regulators have considered this in a bit more detail, they can, indeed determine that this is a particular part of the healthcare sector that's ripe for technology innovation, and perhaps there's many reasons why we should be accelerating access to healthcare remotely as quickly as we possibly can, and maybe therefore then it's an opportunity to set up a different way in which those companies and organisations have to behave, a regulatory body or authority that they've got to report to, implement some kind of standards and some kind of controls, because, you know, as we've all just agreed, this is not consumer products. This is people's health. And it won't just be physical health either. It will be mental health too. This can go into so many really, really highly sensitive and important parts of people's lives, it needs to be dealt with in a completely different way to Amazon's retail and consumer business. So maybe this is an opportunity, and certainly that's what I'd be doing if I was someone that, you know, knew anything at all about the telehealthcare business in the US. That would be the sort of road that I'd be going down. I'd be galvanizing all sorts of experts and opinions to see if there wasn't a way that we could just make sure that the industry is setting up some, you know, guardrails and some boundaries and trying to behave like a mature grown-up industry at the outset. And to be honest, because I don't know anything about the healthcare sector in any detail in the US, maybe there are already organizations and institutions who would be obvious players to be putting those messages forward. I really hope so.
So do I. I think everyone listening does as well. But we'll leave the terrifying thought of Amazon taking control of our health data there for the time being. And we'll move on to our final story, which is the share price of S4 Capital nearly halved last week, declining 46% from £1.2 billion to £700 million. The latest drop marks an 80% decline in the agency holding giant's value this year to date, with S4 having seen 180 million wiped from their share value after publication of their annual results was delayed twice by PwC, the auditor having said they were unable to complete the work necessary, reportedly due to an inaccurate recording of sales by some staff at Media Monks. The slump follows the company reducing their full-year earnings target from around £160 million to £120 million. The revision followed a warning that profit and revenue growth had slowed in the wake of a rapid hiring spree in the content division. Peel Hunt analyst Jessica Pock described the situation as disappointing, but noted that the silver lining is that demand continues to be strong. However, Pock warned that it may take time for S4 Capital to regain investor support. So, obviously things aren't looking very good for S4 Capital. Quite a shaky year, really, all round, and obviously this kind of puts the cherry on the cake. They were, you know, noted for the rapid pace at which they were acquiring, you know, other ad agencies. The Media Monks have acquired over 25 agencies since S4 started, and they've just rapidly bought up, you know, real estate within the sector. Just this month, even they acquired another agency, XX Artists, based in California. Has S4 Capital even grown too quickly for its own good? Is this kind of the inevitable outcome of this rapid, you know, fast-paced attempt to just build an empire? And what impact, if any, do you think that this, you know, will have on S4 and potentially the wider agency landscape? Rachel.
Samadhi, hey, all over the news at the moment, Kieran's best mate. It's hard, on face value, it's hard to tell, right? Because on the one hand, yep, the story's not good if we're looking at things like investor confidence, because it's a reduction in the value, in the overall value of S4 Capital, and it's some not great figures and results for at least two quarters on the trot now. And, you know, if you wanted to be a bit gloom and doom about it, you might be asking yourself, well, how's that going to play out in an environment where advertising spend is reducing in comparison to 2021, certainly in some regions, in some areas, and there's lots of debate about whether it will continue to fall and whether we're heading into a recession. So lots of reasons for investors to feel very edgy. And then what does that mean for Samadhi's onward plans, whatever his acquisition plans might be for the remainder of the year or into 2023 and 2024? Is it going to be, are those conversations with potential investors going to get harder for him? On face value, you might say, yep, that's not, none of that's looking terribly great. But then on the other hand, the more nuanced view, as you've summarized there, Grace, is, well, enormously speedy period of expansion. They kicked all of that off around 2019, which was pre-pandemic, headed into 2020 and 2021, where we know pretty much for sure that the global advertising and marketing industry really experienced relatively good times during 2020 and 2021. So there was lots of opportunity for him to continue that expansion, hire a lot of people. And is this just a natural correction of that? Is that kind of boost and that strange period of time where actually the ad tech, you know, the advertising and marketing industry, never mind the specifically just the tech side of it, did really well during those 2 years when a lot of other industries didn't, and maybe there was always going to be a little bit of a rowback on advertising spend and digital marketing and digital purchasing. So how much is this an indication that there's trouble ahead for S4 Capital and potentially for some other agencies as well? And how much of it is an indication of goings on amongst the S4 Capital empire? It's really hard to tell, because the thing about Sir Martin Sorrell is that, media news stories just follow him around, good, bad or otherwise. And so I find it quite difficult to get to the bottom of what's actually going on. The things that feel kind of gritty in these news stories about S4 Capital, because this has been widely covered, as you mentioned, Grace, is that, external auditors couldn't get to grips with their job and actually publicly said so. That's interesting. What's going on there? And, We know personally many of the people that are working for S4 Capital, both in the APAC region and here in the UK. They're great, really impressive talent, but maybe the business is just expanding too fast, as you suggest. On the other hand, one thing I would say is that if it is just a face value reading of having invested a lot and expanded a lot during effectively boom times, for want of a better way to describe them, and now we're going into a bit of a period of contraction, if there was anywhere in the world that I think it's going to be a good place to be to sort of ride out potential global economic difficulties, it would be APAC. And right at the very start, Sir Martin Sorrell said he was really keen on expanding S4 Capital specifically in the APAC region because he sees such opportunity for growth. So maybe there is method. I'm not going to say in the madness, because it's not quite mad, but, maybe there is method in the strategy. And, it's just so hard to tell. Is this the Samadhi playbook, build, 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 invest, 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 or is it, oh, we've gone a bit too hard, too fast? Not sure.
What do you think, John?
Doesn't look good.
The voice of reason. Love it.
Yeah, I think when you've got your auditor saying that they literally can't do the work that they've been sent in to do in terms of auditing your accounts, then there are a lot of questions to be asked, and it doesn't look good. And in terms of investor confidence, of course, that bottoms out. Like when you hear that, of course, your value is going to drop, and it's dropped sharply and has continued to over the past week. It was... when S4 Capital was started, it was interesting, because I think Sir Martin left WPP under something of a cloud in fairly quiet circumstances, and I think many would have expected at the time him to have ridden off into the sunset, taken his pay packet and what he took from WPP, and kind of, that's it, he'd had a good innings. But no, he started S4 Capital with grew very ambitiously, very quickly. They bought over 30 companies since 2019. It just seems that's they've hit the buffers. The rapid growth has caught up, perhaps the industry changing quite quickly, as we've mentioned with other stories today over the pandemic. The industry has risen and then hit its own buffers. It's an 80% decline is huge. And an interesting thing to see how they come back from this. Jessica Pock's quote that it may take time for them to regain support is telling, and I imagine it might be some time before they can regain that support. And it'll be interesting to see how they go about doing that.
I think an interesting quote from the Guardian article covering this is, for all Sorrell's claims that S4 Capital represents a different business model, it is in effect a traditional advertising agency. And that refers, to the huge emphasis that Sir Martin Sorrell, and, everyone at S4 puts on, disruption and technological advancements. And Rachel, you touched on the fact that, with the pandemic, that really ramped up digitization. Agencies had to get to grips with new technology far more quickly to, meet their clients' demands. Thinking of this quote specifically and also, the case itself, do you think perhaps it's a sign that this digitization has been limited. You know, when a company as big as this that puts such an emphasis on digitization is foiled by, you know, inaccurate sales reporting and, you know, and you know, there are other external factors as well. Does it perhaps highlight the limitations of digitization so far? Bit of a complicated question, perhaps.
But it's a good one, though, because it gets back to the heart of what John was saying. You know, there's something going on there. The fact that that part of the auditor's issues were incorrect sales reporting. Well, what does that mean? Did you sell something or did you not sell something? So, you know, and you're quite right, Grace. They, when they launched S4 Capital, was all about, you know, the principles of data and technology, you know, bringing agency functions together, being fueled by data and technology. Is that vastly different to what a lot of the holding companies are doing at the moment? I don't really think it is, actually. I mean, maybe it felt like it was back in 2019 because holding companies are giant juggernauts that even with their acquisition powers and all the rest of it take some time to implement, you know, new ways of working. But I think these days you could fairly safely say that most holding groups have set up some form of digital first agencies, tech integrations that are enabling their clients to bring their own data, enabling the agencies to offer other data segments and, you know, have got either integrations with or are building their own quite interesting technology solutions. So how different is that from the S4 Capital model? And is it that we were they promising something that they haven't necessarily been able to deliver, or is it the market that's saying, okay, digital transformation is one thing, but you know, actually, are you doing anything truly technically innovative that's different from what's being offered elsewhere? And I'm not sure that even within the vast portfolio of companies that S4 has acquired, I'm not sure the answer to that is yes. I don't think what they're doing is vastly different from what others are doing in the market. Doesn't mean that that's not innovative still or that there isn't some value in that. I think it would just come down to how many customers and clients they can get on board over their competition. And, you know, is that playing out the way, maybe this is an example of how that's not playing out the way that they thought it would. I mean, again, and, you know, if you're going to be playing in that space, you know, nimble, fast-moving, data and tech first, Asia is still a really good market to be putting all of your eggs into that basket because it's very mobile first, it's very tech savvy, it's also very young, a lot of Southeast Asian countries in particular, very young demographic. But you're right, maybe the growth isn't there at the moment.
John, any thoughts on that?
I suppose it's, yeah, it plays into what the market's looking for now as well. I agree with Rachel in that it's, yeah, they grew so quickly and became a big company in a very short space of time. And I think in terms of digital transition, digital transformation and what people are looking for in the tech savvy space, sometimes companies are looking more for smaller, nimble, more kind of targeted companies than they are for the huge, bigger agencies who are, you know, in truth, like a lot of them are trying to turn a tanker rather than spin a jet ski around. They are, they, you know, it's taking time for them to adapt and to bring these things in. And so I think S4 Capital's ambition led them to become something much bigger. And then ultimately it might cost them because it takes a lot longer to turn it around and to actually, again, this goes into the speed of their growth. It's, yeah, keeping track of their own internal machination seems to be an issue. So, yeah, the speed of growth has been an issue. And it's interesting to see if the industry still has trust or confidence or desire to work with these huge conglomerates rather than they do the smaller niche tech-focused companies that we know are starting to exist and starting to thrive.
Yeah, that is a really good point, especially considering, you know, the reports, and this was discussed on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, you know, of how much, you know, brands and marketers are really relying on their agencies now, you know, with this looming recession and, you know, looking for as much guidance as possible, you know, and, you know, following a trend of greater consolidation as well, cutting down how many agencies they're working with, you know, this could, for any agencies that are still, you know, maybe contemplating who to partner with and who to, you know, trust with their marketing spend and their strategies, you know, this maybe could tip the favour towards working with a smaller firm or, you know, to S4 Capital's disadvantage, perhaps just not with one of their roster of agencies. But yeah, very interesting story. We'll have to see how S4's fortunes change, if at all. Surely they will, and we'll, I'm sure, discuss it again on the podcast. But that concludes our discussion of the news of the week. So I'd like to thank you guys, John and Rachel, for the excellent discussion on our three stories. It was great to have the chat.
Thank you very much, Grace. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Great. Definitely a pleasure for me as well, and we really enjoyed it. So that was this week's MedTech Podcast. Thank you all for listening.